This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Bressel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Bressel, April the 1st, 1974, on Dialogue Conspiracy. The bulk of the program will be once more on the Hearst kidnapping, because that is the big story in the country, as far as I can see, in terms of a potential police state and the effect it's going to have upon our prisoners and society in general. But I want to make one announcement on the program and talk about some other conspiracies and information of conspiracies that's coming in the news in the past week, because the Hearst case is important, but there are other matters that we should keep up with, just if we mention them briefly and we can't go into detail. On April the 21st, I'm going to be speaking at the San Jose Civic Auditorium, and this is my first public appearance of anything. This is an experiment in reaching the people in the Bay Area. I haven't done this. I've spoken to colleges in the East, in Syracuse and Dayton University, and they were very successful in terms of the students' interest and their participation in their following study groups. I already got a call from Dayton to return next year. And because on the basis of that, and because of people calling the Bay Area and asking my opinion on different events coming in news-wise, since I have been on this radio program 3 years and have never made a personal appearance, I've talked to so many people, I decided to speak at the San Jose Civic Auditorium. And it's called An Afternoon with Mae Bressel at 1:30 on Sunday, April 21st. Mark your calendars, and I'll announce it next week, too. And the format of the program will be that I will speak for about 40 minutes, like I do at the schools, on political assassinations, the framework of how they are conceived, who plans them, the chain of command, the different departments of government that each have a share in the conspiracy. There are 15 main sections of every major political conspiracy in the country, and I'll briefly go into those. And then I'm going to take questions from the audience, because they will want to ask questions about the current murders. The program is called From Dallas to Oakland. It used to be From Dallas to Memphis, and then it was Dallas to Memphis to Los Angeles, and then it became Dallas to Memphis to Los Angeles to the Watergate, all of these the major conspiracies in the country. And now we go to Oakland, where all of the so-called cult murders, the zombie murders, are taking place, culminating in the next escalation stage of domestic warfare with the Patricia Hearst kidnapping. So I will take questions there, and we'll bring in the Manson killing, the purpose of the Manson, framing Charles Manson, that military operation down in California, Lower California, and the violence of the Frazier and Edmund Kemper, and the up in Santa Cruz, the importance of the syndromes of violence done by the police establishment in order to get more police, more prisons, mental hospitals for experimentations on brain modification, and the study of violence. Will go into the syndrome of the California violences and the Corona murder, and I'll try in that afternoon to give a resume of my research and give sources of information where you can look up some of the things that I'm going to say. Everywhere that I lecture, I give a bibliography, and I'm having printed 3,000 sheets for persons there. I hope we fill that auditorium, and I will talk about assassinations and conspiracies. This last week, referring to conspiracies alone, the news is breaking with the story of 8 people being indicted at Kent State, the National Guardsmen. It's very important. If you think about these conspiracies, people say to me, what good can I do? I'm helpless. A clerk at the Safeway was saying that to me this morning. If I write to a congressman, will he read it? What good does it do? And all I can say is that any progress that society has made in the last couple of years in finding out who is behind the planning of murders or assassinations has been done by a handful of people not working for the government, private citizens like myself, halting brain experimentations, federal funding at least for 2 years, the acquittal of the San Quentin Six up in Northern California, charges of the resulting from the killing of George Jackson, the shootout. The Kent State case is an example of one man, an insurance salesman who lives in Ohio, who came to this country from another country, took his citizenship here, was proud to be an American, and was so chagrined about what was happening, he put together a book called The Truth of Kent State. The families there of the children that were murdered knew that something was wrong. The Justice Department turned down any possibility of indictments or grand jury investigation. The White House got involved in memos and stopped the investigation. But this handful of families, not involved with the FBI, the local police department, the National Guardsmen, all the guardsmen, the officials of the state and the Justice Department in Washington, turned them down. Even the Supreme Court turned them down. And they worked and worked, and now they find out about what happened. They can't stay. They know what happened. They want the public to know. And this is what a group of individuals can do. They can't bring back those dead children. There's no way they can bring those back. But they can prevent the ex-governor of possibly giving orders to men to have guns to shoot children, to maim 13 and kill the other four. They can prevent this kind of thing. 9 were wounded and 4 were killed. There were 13 that were shot at. So that what you do by investigating these things is to halt the process. If it isn't halted, the killings just continue and get out of hand. Another sign of a change is the work of the indictment of Tony Boyle in the Yablonski murders. Here was a man trying to get better wages for mine workers. He was running for office in the mine union. Walter Rother was murdered by assassination. There was an assassination plot from the high-level government of the Treasury Department to kill Cesar Chavez. And in the case of the Yablonski murder, family came in and were ordered, these men and a woman were ordered, two men and women, to kill anybody in the house. And they killed Mr. Yablonski and his wife and his daughter. And now their son, who's living, sat in court this week and looked at Tony Boyle, because the minute these people were arrested, they said they did it for Tony. Tony was the president of the mine workers. So the former United Mine Workers president, W.A. Tony Boyle, is on trial for plotting the murder of the union chief, Joseph Yablonski. If we can get the top level who plot these assassinations, and they're carted off in their wheelchairs, like you see him carted off. He tried to kill himself. And they have to stand trial. Then fewer people are going to hire others to do their killing for them, because the hired men are now speaking up and they don't want to take the rap alone. It was Lee Harvey Oswald who said, "I'm a patsy," and the next day he was killed. Well, the patsies are speaking up, and maybe there won't be so many people to hire when they realize that they're going to be framed and murdered or sent to prison anyway. There was an article in the New York Times dated March 25th by George McMillan. At the top of it says, "Sealing History Behind Walls and Iron Bars." And this article says that James Earl Ray is alive and that the history of who killed Martin Luther King is only locked up because James Earl Ray can't tell what happened. He is locked up there. Now, when my Watergate article came out that I wrote in July 1972, I suggested that we get Sirhan Sirhan and James Earl Ray and Arthur Bremer and offer them immunity. And this was quite a revolutionary idea. This was almost 2 years ago. Offer these men immunity from anything. Give them money. Give them $100,000 or what. Get them out of the country. Give them a passport to whatever they want. Let them tell the chain of command of each of those particular operations that they were involved in, because Sirhan Sirhan did not kill Robert Kennedy. He wants a new trial. He wants to talk. James Ray did not kill Martin Luther King. He says there's a conspiracy and he wants to talk. And Arthur Bremer had co-partners. In fact, there were two guns that shot in Laurel Plaza when George Wallace was shot. He could talk. And here is an article saying that history is behind walls. And to me, it is repulsive to think of denying ourselves this information, as it is for Earl Warren to tell us, as the Chief Justice of the United States, at the time the Warren Report came out, that we can't know the truth about who killed President Kennedy in our lifetime. That guise of national security has been blown apart with the Watergate. It's perfectly obvious from all the articles you read and understand that national security is personal security. In fact, Senator Baker said it last week with regard to the Watergate tapes, the controversial tapes. He said the hiding of the CIA responsibility in the Watergate affair and the possible involvement of their foreknowledge of it, and a lot of what's classified national security isn't national security at all. It's personal security. So people that on the inside that are saying it, or people that want to be president someday, maybe like Senator Baker, are saying it right there. And there's no reason for the classification of national security. And here these men are living. That Jack Ruby is dead. He wanted to talk. Oswald is dead. But here these other men are living and want to talk. And we talk about national resources that we're not using. And here we have these political patsies sitting in little cells, 5x9, lying on a concrete strip, and we're not even using what they know, and they're begging to tell what they know, and that is a national disgrace. There was an article that came over the news service tonight. It also was in the LA Times this week. George Wallace sees a death attempt on him as a conspiracy. Now, I have the telephone number of George Wallace in my book. I called members of his party immediately. Those of you that have listened to KLRB, remember the broadcast I did immediately after he was shot and followed for 2 or 3 weeks quite closely the conspiracy to kill George Wallace. And then the Watergate confirmed who the men were and the channel of money that was going through. So now George Wallace comes out in March of 74. And he said, you think one fellow can follow you all over the country who never hardly made $30 a week in his life? How can he buy an automobile? How can he buy 2 guns? He stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, goes to massage parlors, rents limousines, goes to Canada. It was all over Michigan. He followed me around. This is what Wallace is saying. He says he questioned all along about Arthur Brammer, but the FBI told them that they had given him all the information they had. Now, that's the same FBI that was in on the killing of Fred Hampton, the Black Panther in Chicago, and Mark Clark. It's the same FBI that closed the case at Kent State or closed the killing of Yablonsky. The FBI selects what it wants them to know, like it selects for the Hearst family what they want to know. So he said the diary was written for Brammer. He copied it. He was not a loner. And Wallace said, I have confidence in the FBI, but that doesn't mean that Brammer was a loner or that the case is solved at all. He wants to know where he got his money. And then he asks a good question. Why would a fellow leave a diary when he never wrote one in his life? Why an assault all of a sudden would he leave a diary? So that case is wide open. All we need now, if Sirhan were able to talk about the Robert Kennedy, if Arthur Brammer were allowed to talk about the shooting of Wallace, and if James Ray could tell about shooting Martin Luther King, all we need is Ted Kennedy to tell you about Chappaquiddick and how Mary Jo Kopechne was killed, and then this country would be in a much safer place than it is today while all of these things are covered up. Meanwhile, the FBI is taking their lumps at the Indians trial. Every one of their conspiracy trials has fallen apart. In fact, the judge scolded the FBI. He said he thought that they were a fairly good service, but he said they've certainly gone downhill. The judge was shocked at the work that the FBI did in the Indian investigation and the entire Wounded Knees affair. And he was exploding. Judge Fred J. Nickel said, in quotes, he was greatly disturbed about the FBI's role in this case, and he felt that the agency, which he formerly held in high esteem, had deteriorated badly. So the book I'm doing, Murderville, USA, goes into the role of the FBI and the CIA doing many, many tricks, dirty tricks, to effect a scare in this country against minorities, blacks, prisoners, anti-war movements, and they do this by political assassination, mainly by political assassination and conspiracy. Now, we're getting a whole chain of kidnappings that I'll go to in a minute, and then we'll get on to the Hearst kidnapping for the remainder of the program. But there was a beautiful article by Police Chief Davis in Los Angeles. That's the chief of police. It's mentioned in the Glass House Tapes, Lewis Tackwood's book, on exposure of the criminal conspiracy section of the Los Angeles Police Department, how they plan assassinations, send innocent men to death row, send them to prison, their systematic murder of minorities down in Los Angeles. Well, Chief of Police Davis was also there at the time Robert Kennedy was killed, and he's all of a sudden coming forward. He calls a look at Watergate the year of the jackal. And I wondered, what has Police Chief Davis got to say about the Watergate now? And he makes a very some interesting comments. He refers to the Senate Select Committee investigating the Watergate affair as the dog and pony show of last year. He called it a soap opera giving national building to the president's people. He said since these men were made villains on national television, they won't get a fair trial. But then he gets very angry about the White House tapes. He said, this is Chief of Police Davis, I have participated in 5 meetings at the White House, and I personally don't want anyone to listen to the conversations of those meetings. Well, you better believe he doesn't want to, because Louis Tackwood said that the plans for planned murder at the Republican convention in 1972 at San Diego were linked to that secret police agency in the White House that was connected to Chief of Police Davis of the Los Angeles Police Department. So this is what Davis is saying. He says, there's nothing culpable about what I said. I talked to Harry Dent. Harry Dent is the man who was in charge of the Southern strategy in the White House. And I talked to John Ehrlichman, and I talked to Egil Crow, and I talked to the President of the United States, and I had no idea that my voice or my thoughts were being recorded. And it's no one's damn business what was said between me and any other individual. Now, the chief's getting really angry here. He says it's no one's damn business what we said. Well, I think it is, because that city has been responsible for political kidnappings. It was also the city where, when the offices of Dr. Fielding were robbed, the whole Ellsberg case that is so well known in the news now, that a man in the Los Angeles police jail, Elmer Davis, was charged for the robbery when he was locked up at jail the night that they broke into the office. So the police department had on the books that Elmer Davis, who refers to himself as a scapegoat and has a $1 million lawsuit against these particular departments, it sure makes a difference what Chief of Police Davis was doing in the White House. I'd like to hear those tapes, because they have to do with the 72 election. And you might write back to the Senate Select Committee and say, look, you don't fold up till May. Let's get the tapes on Davis and see once and for all if Louis Tackwood was right about the plans of violence. So he can check the dates, because Tackwood had a press conference when this was going on. Davis says, this is where he gets concerned, and this is really funny. This is quotes from the LA Times. He said, it violates my First Amendment right to free speech. If I feel when I talk to a public figure, it's going to be recorded and played back to the world. I'm afraid to use my right to free speech. On the other hand, it violates his Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable search and seizure, because the tapes contain my voice, and the seizure violates my Fifth Amendment, my right not to incriminate myself. Beyond the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, due to the process, is the fundamental fairness. Now, here's a man who has a prisoner, Joseph Jenkins, sitting up in San Quentin, who would have been killed if the death penalty hadn't been halted, who Louis Tackwood got paid salary to come from New Orleans to frame Joseph Jenkins, and I met Jenkins up in San Quentin. I'm trying to get lawyers to get him out. Here's Chief of Police Davis talking about his First Amendment, his Fourth Amendment, his Fifth Amendment, his 14th Amendment, and he's got a house full of innocent men, all black, sitting in prisons, not having committed any crime, and he's worried about his amendments, and he's talking about fairness. Now, this has to be the funniest article. If any of you go to a library, copy it. It's March the 25th, 1974, Chief of Police Davis calls this the year of the jackal. They could get his hide so fast if they pulled those tapes, because his conversations in the White House must be worth a fortune. And because we live in California, and the violence taking place in the Northern Bay Area affects us, that's why we should hear those tapes, because Donald DeFries was an agent of the Los Angeles Police Department. For 2 years, he was arrested catching 200 guns, shooting a policeman, having bomb possession, allegedly. He was never really put in jail until 69, and he was protected by the Los Angeles Police Department. So then Chief of Police Davis is crying about the grand jury. Now listen to this. He says he doesn't like the grand jury. The indictments are unconstitutional. It's a legal rack and screw of the 20th century. You have no choice. You have no options. The grand jury, he says, is a medieval hangover. I wonder how long it will last. Now listen to the irony. Here's Robert Mardian, Assistant Attorney General, creating the grand jury to get the radicals, the anti-war people, the blacks, the Panthers, the protesters, the Chicanos. What the grand jury did, every one of their phony cases has been overturned. The Angela Davis, the shootout, the San Quentin Six, the indictments were dropped, the Indian Affairs is being dropped, the Vietnam veterans, everything. The grand jury was an inquisition against one side of this country, the poor, the oppressed. But now the grand jury is going at Ehrlichman and Haldeman, and it could be Chief of Police Davis next. They've got Robert Mardian back there and Fred LaRue and all their team, John Mitchell and Maurice Stans. Now the grand jury has turned around, and it's on white America, rich white America, the co-conspirators the grand jury is working. And all of a sudden they tell you it's the Inquisition. That's pretty funny. It's working on Donald Segretti and all these people. So think about it. Now, this is what Chief of Police Davis, he says grand juries are secret. They don't have a judge. They have a prosecutor and an overzealous man who wants to make a reputation. It's a one-sided representation. This is a very funny article. He says it isn't fair. Now he says, where's the Civil Liberties Union? They were talking about the other pack, and this fool is actually asking for the Civil Liberties Union to talk about the grand conspirators that took our country away from us. They had a constitution drawn up that had no amendments to it at all. All of them were to be gone. Thanks to Mr. Berger, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he was to have no trial by jury at all. We weren't supposed to have 1 to 14 at all. And he's telling you his 1 to 14 is going by the wayside. This is a classical article, Los Angeles Times. I'm repeating for the third time, March 28th, 1974. Police Chief Davis takes a look at the Watergate, the year of the jackal, cut it out and paste it inside the book, Glass House Tapes, and then ask yourself what he's talking about. And we'll go back to his agents and the articles. And they, we said, announced, Donna announced this week, I talk about the articles in the Chronicle on the Seminese Liberation Army, and we'll go to those in 1 minute. Before we get to those, the effect of the army, of course, we'll summarize it, is to get tough on the prisoners, stop mail from coming into the prisoners. The scare, a great psychologist from Brandeis University, a great CIA front, is yelling, we're going to have all these other kidnappings ever since the Hearst kidnapping. Look at all those have followed. Well, just an example, John Patterson, the American diplomat in Mexico. The Mexican authorities say they doubt the kidnapping report. They saw him sitting in a car that was chained to another car, and he was laughing. They were at a service station when he left the consulate, and his car, he was with an unidentified man, and they were calm, and they weren't guarded. And they said Patterson's car was chained to a camper truck and towed away, and he was sitting there laughing. And they said that ransom note was 2 pages long, and it was doubtful that he would have had time to be spirited away to a hideout. So Henry Kissinger is down there on his honeymoon. I'm sure he's settling that Mexican kidnapping in his free time. Another ridiculous kidnapping we haven't gone into was the Princess Anne. The usual conclusion is Scotland Yard, closely affiliated British intelligence with the CIA, a schizoid kidnapped Princess Anne. This schizoid takes a white car, pulls it up in front of her car on a busy street, one door off to the palace. She's sitting with 3 men, her husband and 2 bodyguards, a driver and a bodyguard. He's supposed to kidnap her. If that was a kidnapping, I don't know. It's so ridiculous and so far-fetched that he could even take her away. If he wanted to kill her, he could just shoot her. He couldn't kidnap her anywhere. The streets were crowded. His car is blocked. He's a former mental patient, and if you chart all of these cases, and this is why I'll talk in San Jose on the 21st about our mental patients, Mr. Frazier and Mr. Mullen, our local mental patients, all of them, Lawrence Kwong at San Diego, involved the KGO shooting. This guy was a mental patient who had no job. Now, he had $700 in his pocket. He was well-financed, and they say he was unemployed. But it has the pattern of all the other phony conspiracies. He couldn't possibly have taken her away. He was heavily funded. But what happened is that there's a new business. It's called security guards. You see them at airports. You'll see them around families. The Onassis family I read today is all guarded. Jackie and everybody heavily guards. The new security, private security forces are watching everybody. The name of the game is terror and fear, and these are all phony. Like 9/10 of the hijackings were government provocateurs, but you got a guard at every airport. The hijacking stopped, not because you have the guards at the airport, but because they have what they want now, so they don't have to bother with all these planes and all this money. But the point is, this Princess Anne was another ridiculous series. Every one of these kidnappings, a little boy in New York City was kidnapped by a group of Cubans. A woman said this week, he sat in the hall and he went down the bathroom. They were laughing and kidding. He seemed to know everybody. He was returned home. There's been a bunch of mini kidnappings. The wife of the banker up in Minneapolis. The professor
like in Nazi Germany, professors were used. The professor at Brandeis had mentioned all the kidnappings that have come along that we can expect these rash of violences. Every one of these kidnappings that I've studied, that I've been studying as they break in the news, is a phony kidnapping. It's the domino theory that we had in Asia brought it home. It was, if Lee Harvey Oswald shot Kennedy for these reasons, because he was a loner and misfit, then James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King, and then Sirhan shot Robert Kennedy, and Arthur Brammer went to a library and read about Oswald and all the other alleged assassins, and all of them were conspiracies, the same way with our trial. So what we're having now is a syndrome of kidnapping conspiracies that are a bunch of hogwash. Well, I did a lot of homework this week for you and for articles I'm writing and so forth. There were three articles in the San Francisco Chronicle that were important. If people didn't get them in back east to hear this show, I'll give you a resume of what they were about. The first article came out March the 27th on the origins of the SLA, Symbionese Liberation Army. Now, this article, you have to remember that in every conspiracy, the news media, the propaganda, is as important as any bullet or weapon that goes off at all. The news media is an important branch of Read Mein Kampf, and you see how propaganda works. So there's an article called The Origins of the Symbionese Liberation Army, and the top of it says, Peaceful Beginnings. What they're going to try and tell you is that well-meaning people came in and it ended in all this. After all our gratitude of wanting to help all these nice prisoners, look what happens. The second article, big headlines, the SLA fantasy. The fantasy they built up was that they were going to do dreams for the world. It says from dreams to reality. And this is it turns to a reality from the romantic vision of a world where all the the hungry people would be fed by Randolph Hearst in 1 month. That's a real, from a dream to reality. And then the third article calls a twist of fate for the SLA, as if something went wrong. A strange set of circumstances caught them up. Well, I read these three articles. It took me 3 days. I got about 60 typewritten pages from it, and I could chart it and diagram, and I could come out with it enough information like I did my chart and diagram of the Watergate affair, and I'll give you a resume. And if you have a pencil and paper, and I'm talking too fast, take some of this down as I do it, and you'll get an idea of what I'm trying to say. In the first place, when I saw the picture, the origins of the SLA, on the front page of the Chronicle is a huge picture, and it's got a picture of one black man with other white men. There's six white men, and in the middle is a black man, and they have a fist, the revolutionary fist, and that's the front page. That's to scare America that there's really a big army or team, and that one picture is worth 1,000 words, but in order to understand the black revolutionary fist, get some books like Soledad Brothers or Blood in My Eye, and there's some marvelous books out, Soul on Ice, two of them by George Jackson, one by Cleaver, and see where California prisons were in 69 and 70 and 71 when this big black fist at Vacaville Medical Center was going up because they were breaking up all political groups. Black was turned against white, against Chicano, and they still are that way, put in segregated cells. There was determination historically. In 1961 to 1970, the FBI memo showed to break up all these groups. In 1970 to 72, the White House Intelligence Agency was breaking them up. And the books on California prisons will tell you about segregation and isolation. So there is no way that this big military thing was going on. But this is a photograph of them in Vacaville. The summary of the articles as I read them was that Donald DeFries is to be the patsy of the entire operation. The whole pitch of the article is all these nice white people came in with the goodness of their heart, brought them their wonderful time, and this is the thanks they get. The system turned against them. They came in to give them their aid, and they came from out of nowhere into prison groups to see these blacks, and it all turned sour. The article praises the intelligence and the coolness of all the do-gooders, the whites that involved into this scene, and I call them the migratory birds, Mr. and Mrs. Atwood and Harris and Willie Wolf. They were altruistic, the adjective says. They were unselfish. They were intelligent. And what happened to all these do-gooders after the arrest, after Patricia Hearst was kidnapped and Romero and Little had to be sacrificed to San Quentin and put in prison, they split like hell. They went out. They're all over the country. The FBI, with all of their know-how, hasn't picked them up as suspects of anything because they were the connecting links, bringing the cover story that do-gooders do good in the prisons, and then the violence from the prisons comes out to the streets because these people have connections inside the prisons. And the thanks you get for letting all these nice white people in the prisons, this is going to be the script for the months to come, is that the gratitude you get was that they kidnapped Patricia Hearst, they escaped and took this lovely white princess. That's going to be the script. And Romero has to be sacrificed. Well, I broke these articles down into several different charts, three or four different charts. One, there was on how where they live, the geographic area, the site of their particular homes. One, that number one, if you have a pencil and make a left-hand column, and we've done this on other shows if you're familiar with it, on the left-hand side, put military connections, because this is a paramilitary operation run from the National Security Council. Colston Westbrook, the black man that you saw on television one night, Big Daddy, Colston Westbrook was the black contact man from coming home from Southeast Asia, who went to UC University up at Berkeley teaching black language, was the contact man from the National Security Council into Vacaville, into the prisons. So on the left, I have a chart that says Colston Westbrook as the military man, and the other military man involved will be Joseph Romero. He's the street military. One is the head trip, the intellectual programming, Donald DeFries, and he's going to be a hero. And he's going to escape, and with his romantic vision of helping all the oppressed and poor, there is a head man who plans. And there's a street man, like in the Ellsberg case, Howard Hunt makes the plans for the opening up into Dr. Fielding's office, but he isn't indicted for it. But Barker and Martinez and those men are the street men, De Diego. Those are the street men that break in, that mess up the papers. And if there's murders, there's gunmen. You see, there's head men that do the planning, and there's street men that do the operating. So the head man of the domestic, Colston Westbrook, is to bring the intellectual idea from the streets into Vacaville, where they do the behavior modification of Donald DeFries, who's been sent up from the LAPD. And the head man, and the street man is going to be Romero, the military who came home from Vietnam, who has the know-how with the cyanide weapons, who will have the weapons on him. He had a Brazilian gun on him. He will be the street man with the weapons and in the contact. Now, that is your military. In your middle, if you have a piece of paper and you're following this, there is a street man who is an intelligence operation or planner. In this case, his name is Dave Gunnell, G-U-N-N-E-L-L. Now, the street man, he's in his late 30s. Now, that's, in the article, they say late 30s. 31, 32, 33, you'd see where he'd have people 22 years old or young students living with him. 38, 39, maybe 40 by now. An older man who, the articles in the Chronicle said, acquired a house. Now, these are the little links I work on. It doesn't say if he bought a house or if he rented a house. It was a house big enough for three or four or five couples to live in. So it's a pretty good size house, and the rent must be pretty high in Berkeley. Whether he bought it is important, because whether he acquired it through purchasing $30,000 or $40,000 house is important, because he's going to be selling Chinese food down on Shattuck or one of those streets over there. Each one of these people has an occupation way out of proportion to their standard of living, and we don't know really what his business is. His cover is that he had a jazz band, but so that you don't ask where he played, they also tell you that it didn't play anywhere. It was a failure. Now, Dave Gunnell acquires a place called the Peking House, and that's why Senator Harmer goes to the Senate Subcommittee on Civil Rights in Sacramento and says Chinese Maoists are involved in this. There's no Chinese Maoists involved in the SLA. That is the cover story for the scare tactics up in Sacramento, and I sent letters this week, because Dave Gunnell, an American, is selling Chinese food. It's not even made by him. On a street in Berkeley doesn't mean the Chinese Maoist kidnapped or influenced Patricia Hearst kidnapping. So across the paper on the right-hand side, there's a name, Kamala Hall. She's from the University of Minnesota, has a bachelor's degree, did social work there for 3 years, and she came to Berkeley in 1971. Now, Westbrook, Gunnell, and Kamala Hall are the three connecting links, the most important at the top planning stage. Now, it's hard in the remaining 10 minutes to go through the entire diagram, but the resume, the way It reads, if I can do it simply, is this. Colston Westbrook comes home from Vietnam, and he is suspected of being an agent, not only by Donald DeFries. He says on television, I know you think I'm a pig. Brother, let's be brothers. He says, nigger to nigger, you know, this kind of dialect. But even the newspaper people that saw him over at Berkeley all walked away and knew he was suspicious. Well, Westbrook is going into Vacaville prison and meeting Donald DeFries twice a week. And a person from his class at UC Berkeley by the name of Willie Wolf, who came out here from Pennsylvania, who's 22 years old, goes from the UC Berkeley classes with Westbrook into the Vacaville prison. And they begin this black cultural association. Now, Wolf has no experience with blacks, and Westbrook is all military. But they're going to help poor Donald DeFries. You can see how they've helped him. He's sitting on a limb. Okay, now, Willie Wolf lives at a house. He goes to class. He goes to Colston's classes, but he lives in a house. And it's owned by Dave Cannell, called the Peking House. And the Peking House is the place where all, I call them the migratory birds from the East Coast, are to dwell, who are going to go into the prison system and create this inside-outside system between San Luis Obispo, Folsom, San Quentin, and Soledad, which is so highly suspicious because in late 72, they come from nowhere, from other states, and they're in the California prison, and you don't know how hard it is to get in to see if these are black radicals, to visit them, and if you visit them, they know everything about you. California was having its own problems. Again, I've studied the California prisons and conspiracies inside and outside. So I know that it would be very strange for all these people to converge into this kind of a program. And the proof of what I'm saying would be to check where they were before and where they are now. That's the proof of what I'm saying on the air. So a Joseph Little and Robin Steiner, they came out here in the fall of 72 and went right to Vacaville to this class with Wolf and Westbrook. There was a Bill Harris and Emily Harris who came out from Indiana in the fall of 72. And they were all living at this house with Willie Wolf. And they were to start visiting these prisoners. Now, at this another branch, if I can get it straight, these people were coming. Joseph Little, Robin Steiner, Bill Harris, Emily Harris came out here from Florida and from Indiana. And they lived at the house of Dave Gunnell with Willie Wolf. And they all start visiting the California prisons and the prisoners. Now, there was another set of contacts. This Camilla Hall came out from Minnesota, and she was living in Berkeley. And a girl named Ms. Moon became friends of hers. Her real name, she has another name, Barbara, and I can't pronounce the last name. It's a Polish name. Barbara and the young lady, Camilla Hall from Minnesota, were friends. And Ms. Moon from Santa Barbara had been at UC Berkeley 4 years. And it was at this house of Ms. Moon's that Donald DeFries escaped. Donald DeFries was meeting Wolf and Little at Vacaville. And he was transferred to Soledad in December 72. And in March, he escaped. And he called his friends who lived at the Peking House, and they had him living at Ms. Moon's house in Berkeley. And that was his safe house until the Patricia Hearst kidnapping took place. Ms. Moon had been at the University of California 4 years studying social science and English, but she didn't use her education. She was a part-time janitor at the library in Berkeley, and that's where they were getting the diagrams of the Cobra and the books on the origin of Eastern philosophy that were also identical to the Ron Karenga CIA documents. I'm sure they were turned on which ones to use that were identical to the CIA, Los Angeles Police Department documents. They were using them at the Berkeley Library. They didn't tell Donald DeFries the connections, maybe he didn't know the connections to Ron Karenga of the CIA in Los Angeles, but a member of Ron Karenga and the CIA and the LAPD was part of the SLA up at Vacaville also with Donald DeFries. So he was housed when he was let out, and it was not escape, when he was let out of Soledad, taken by members of the prison to a room at 12 o'clock, and they didn't come back till 1, and he was gone, and the guards were not there. There were no guards, no guns, and there were clothing waiting. He was taken in a car, and he went up to Berkeley, and he lived with Ms. Moon. Now, there was one man who went back and forth from the house of Ms. Moon to the Peking House that Dave Gunnell lived in. His name is Gary Thompson. He's a black man, and he lived in, well, he didn't live at the Peking House. He went back and forth and in and out, and he dated Nancy Ling Perry, and he also dated Ms. Moon. So the chain of command, I'll be publishing this diagram in articles, but I did want to read it on the air. The chain of command, as far as I'm concerned, is broken down as to how these operatives met. You see, they didn't have to see each other after Donald DeFries escaped from Soledad. He didn't have to see Colston Westbrook anymore. Westbrook didn't have to know where he was. But so long as he was with Ms. Moon and Nancy Ling Perry, whose name becomes DeVoto, she then rents a house on Sutherland Court with Mr. Little, who came out from Florida. And they begin their dwelling, and it's from that house they were living and where DeFries was also visiting. He could go back and forth into that house. See, Donald DeFries never had to be at the Peking House, or he could be, because the police certainly weren't looking for him after he escaped. So what I did with these Chronicle articles, I took the three of them. If any of you want to be researchers, I get letters from people in Santa Cruz, would be researchers or people working on assassinations. If you take those three articles and reread them again, the certain names of people that are involved, plus new articles that will come out and old ones that have, and keep in mind the resume that I have done. You can follow the news later. After I made my original charts on the Watergate, after 3 weeks after their arrest, then everything that comes out since that time, it's been a year, three quarters, fits into that original chart. So that I feel if you take this chart and follow it and remember these names, the military connections were Colston Westbrook, who made the introductions of the white people from the East who were to come into the prisons. Jose Romero would be the military contact on the outside for the actual kidnapping, because that was a pretty slick operation. The weapons, the kidnapping, the military planning. The patsies, the Lee Harvey Oswalds of this, are going to be Theo Wheeler and Donald DeFries, who will be murdered, even if Patricia Hearst is alive. They will kill them because they're a cutoff and they're expendable. The black contact men to reach the two black men are Gary Thompson, who could work in and out of the safe house with Donald DeFries, and Westbrook, who was working in and out of the prisons. The contact women were Camilla Hall, who was working with Ms. Moon, and Nancy Ling Perry through Mr. Thompson. Those were the contacts. Now, the cutoffs are your well-educated white people who could create the scene of terror in our California prisons and leave. So what we've left is a bunch of new laws, new restrictions on prisoners, repressions coming down, and those people have left town. And don't tell me the FBI can't find these particular people. It's absolutely ridiculous. They can't find, we haven't heard a word about Emily Harris or Bill Harris. He's a graduate. He has a BA and MA. He was teaching junior high at Indiana, at a school there, a junior high. He's gone back to Indiana. You haven't heard anything about them in the news. You haven't heard anything about Nancy DeVoto since she fled. The word is they vanished. They just vanished. That's such an interesting word. Nancy DeVoto is a Goldwater person, conservative mentally, went to Whittier College, came up to the Bay Area. And if you read these Chronicle articles, you think it was from the goodness of their heart. They were these bleeding hearts that they came into the prison. When you read it out, they were officially sanctioned by the university. And when you read the adjectives, you would think that there weren't kinder people in the whole world. And Angela Atwood was connecting with, supposedly at San Luis Obispo, with Doc Holliday. Now, Doc Holliday is a friend that I correspond with. And I started a thing called Prisoners of America because I believe sincerely that if everybody would take a pen pal and write to them, we would know more about what's going on to the prisons. And this is what they want to stop. They want to involve the prisons in this Patricia Hearst kidnapping, even though the men are behind bars, because they don't want you to know what's happening. So Angela Atwood and her husband, the professor, come out to Berkeley. What do? Gary Atwood goes to the post office, and he has a post office, a helmet, a clerk. He delivers mail. Here's a man with a master's degree. All of these people are overeducated for the jobs they had. I have a memo from the Warren Commission hearings. It's from the National Archives, of the commission questioning why Lee Harvey Oswald was moving books in the depository when he could have jobs for his education, electronics and radar and language skills. He had a lot of opportunities open other than this, so they thought there was another reason for him being where he was. Well, you had Angela Atwood and Gary Atwood coming out from Indiana, Joseph Little and Robin Steiner coming out from Florida, Joanne Little was evidently in California, Nancy DeVoto, all of these people coming in and messing around with these poor black radicals. Didn't have enough problems, but they come in and mess around with them and smear them, and so the restrictions keep getting tighter and tighter on the prisoners, and that is the purpose, to come down tight on the prisoners. Now, there was an interesting escape in San Quentin this week. We'll do it next week. We don't have time. It's two members of Ron Karenga's CIA Los Angeles Police Department who were sleeping in their little bed outside the prison gate. Known killers who killed two Black Panthers who left a note for Mommy and Daddy last night that they just had to go because the prisons were oppressive. And that goes back to Chief of Police Davis. I'll pick that up next week because we're leaving off now. And time is out. We never have enough time. So save all your papers on the kidnappings and murders, and we'll continue next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. And stay well. Goodbye.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.